Hello, welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, April 9th. I'm Dagna, your reader today. We'll start with the five-day forecast for the Siouxland area, and today is going to be warmer with sunny intervals with a high of 67 and a low tonight of 36. Wednesday will be breezy in the afternoon, a high of 70 and a low of 39. Thursday is going to be partly sunny, it'll be windy, and it'll be a little bit cooler with a high of 58 and a low of 34. Friday will be sunny, pleasant, and warm up a little bit with a high of 67 and a low of 41. Saturday is going to be warmer with clouds and sun with a high of 81 and a low of 48. Our first story is concerning the big news from yesterday was the solar eclipse, and Sioux City catches a few glimpses of the solar eclipse. Mother Nature trumped the greater universe's eagerly anticipated light show in Sioux City. For much of the early afternoon Monday, local residents hoping to catch the solar eclipse kept looking up to the sky, only to have those hopes dashed because of thick clouds. A few breaks in the clouds gave excited viewers gathered at the Sioux City Public Museum's plaza brief glimpses of the sun, partially blocked by the moon. "Everybody look now," someone called out during one such break. On went the eclipse glasses, back tilted the heads, followed by oohs and ahs for a few seconds before the clouds covered the sun once again. Though not what everyone was hoping for, the few seconds brought some satisfaction. "It's just cool how God created the universe and seeing it working how it's supposed to," said Elise Morris, who came from South Sioux City to the museum with her husband Tim and their sons Simon 4 and Owen 1. Though there weren't many chances to see it, the eclipse was a fun way to discuss science with their boys, Tim Morris said. "It's a good thing for the boys to teach them about the solar system," he said. Prior to Monday, the family had watched videos explaining the eclipse to their children, and Simon knew that the orange circle, the sun, he was there to see was going to get blocked by the black circle, the moon. Unfortunately for Simon and everyone else, there weren't many circles of any color to see in the sky on Monday. As the eclipse neared its peak of 75% coverage at 1:55 p.m., the clouds got darker and darker, dimming any last hope those gathered had of getting a good look. 10 minutes later, many were returning their eclipse glasses to the museum staff and heading home or back to work. The weather may not have cooperated, but Teresa Weaver, the museum's curator of education, wasn't going to let it dim her spirits. She was happy to see a small crowd come together to share in the experience, even if it didn't pan out as hoped. Weaver said, "It's an opportunity to have a nice community event. I just enjoy this, the mix of people talking with each other about what they are seeing." Our next story is titled, "What Happens If the Marina Does Not Open? Sioux City Area Boaters Face Unappealing Choices." Dakota City, Nebraska. Russ Hodges is worried the closure of the Sioux City Marina this year will do serious damage to his business. Hodges, who runs Simarina Boats, a Dakota City boat dealership that also offers boat servicing and boat storage, estimated that he counts at least 90% of the boats at the marina, or rather the boat's owners, as customers. "It's huge," he said. The slump would commence almost immediately. Hodges told the Journal, "Number one, they're not going to have us de-winterize the boats, get them ready, so that's going to cost us a lot of parts and labor. From there, the downturn accelerates. A lot of people might just say, hey, being as I can't use my boat, I'm going to sell it. So you're going to have the market flooded with used boats for sale, which would directly impact my new and used boat sales. And then if you don't have the boats in the water being used, it's directly going to hurt any service that I get out of the use throughout the year," he said. Hegg Companies, operator of the Sioux City Marina, announced last month that the marina will not open this year due to low water levels. That was something of an oversimplification. "The problems at the marina," said Paul Hegg, president and CEO of Hegg Companies, "are more attributable to a long-term pattern of drought and low runoff punctuated by occasional floods. Years of heavy silt buildup requiring dredging each year has taken its toll on the marina, Hegg said, while the dock infrastructure has been damaged by years of lower water levels than it was designed for. He estimated 20% of the boat slips at present cannot be rented out due to the sediment buildup underneath them, so you would not be able to get a boat in and out of there. The city of Sioux City is the owner of the property, but has leased it to private operators for many years. City officials have been unequivocal in their position that the marina needs to open this summer. City Manager Bob Padmore and the Assistant City Attorney Amber Hegarty told the Journal that Hegg's lease on the property does not allow for it to be closed this summer. Mayor Bob Scott wrote in a Facebook comment that they, meaning Hegg, need to honor their lease and get it opened. A copy of the lease obtained by the Journal spells out the city's recourse in the event the lease is breached. One of the city's options is to terminate the lease and take control of the property. Jason John is one of the marina regulars considering selling his boat, a 21-foot Crown Line he purchased new in 2018 and uses 2 to 5 times a week in the summer for pleasure rides. Like others at the marina, he does not find the public Missouri River boat ramps terribly appealing or convenient. "I will either use the ramp sparingly or I will put my boat up for sale," said John of Sioux City. "Because I just have a 2-car garage, so I don't have room to really store the boat." John has had a slip at the marina for about 12 years. In the early years, because of a personal arrangement he had, he paid for his slip with labor services. In more recent years, he has paid about $2,200 annually for his slip in the D dock. John said, "It's so much more convenient to just get in there, take the cover off, lower the lift, and go, compared to hauling the boat down there to the ramp and dealing with people at the ramp. So I hope they would reopen." Dustin Curry of Sioux City has leased a slip on the marina sea dock for his 22-foot Four Winds boat for the past 3 years. He said boaters had taken notice of marina silt problem before the events of this spring. He said, "Last year we were having some struggles getting our boats on and off our lifts, adding that in his view, the marina really hasn't been very well maintained over the last few years and they haven't dredged. The situation baffles Corey in light of the roughly $2,800 a year he pays to use a slip and lift. There should be plenty of money there to dredge the marina," he said. John, likewise, said he's witnessed conditions deteriorating at the marina and said the people in charge have not been responsive when he's raised concerns. Last year, he had trouble getting his boat off the lift, likely due to silt buildup, and a dead tree got stuck in the water at the edge of his dock. "It's just been going downhill," he said. Hegg, who acknowledged that no one's overly happy with the situation, said last week that his company is hoping to get a bathymetric survey of the marina done soon to get a better understanding of the conditions at the bottom of the marina and how to best handle the sediment problem. Padmore said the city's view is that Hegg should tend to the Hegg should tend to the dredging. It's one of their responsibilities of operating the marina, he said. For his part, Hegg said that exiting the marina business is not out of the question should it become untenable from his perspective. "I think all options are on the table. We are good partners with the city. We understand this is an amenity of the community that people want and desire, but, you know, it's got to make sense for everybody." The Missouri River Boat Club, a riverside social organization of boating people and others who enjoy the river, actually benefited somewhat from the marina's announcement. For a number of years, the club has sought to boost its membership rolls, particularly dock members, who pay more to the club and, as the name implies, get a dock. Waning membership was an acute cause for alarm 4 years ago when riverbank erosion of the Big Sioux River threatened their old clubhouse. A new clubhouse has since been built farther from the riverbank. The club's dock membership situation shifted rather suddenly when the marina announced it would be closed. "We had 5 docks for sale. They're already sold," the weekend of the announcement, said Dennis Butler, the club's fleet captain. "They are all sold pretty much right away, so we're full." Corey said he considers the boat club, but he found its docks were spoken for. "So that sounds like that may not be an option for us." The boat club has a total of 28 docks and a wait list should one come available. Internally, the club has even examined the cost of building new docks, which the user would have to foot the bill for. "We can always add docks if they're willing to build them," Butler said. "They're not cheap." The Missouri River boat ramps at Sioux City and South Sioux City will remain open to the public this summer, parks officials from both cities told the Journal. But the public ramps are not appealing to all boaters, partially because of the relative inconvenience and partly for other reasons. Corey said he decided to lease a slip at the marina largely because he found conditions at Sioux City's ramp at Chris Larson Park, just off the southernmost end of Hamilton Boulevard, crowded, chaotic, and off-putting. "That was the reason I switched and got a slip in the first place, was because they don't run the ramp area probably as it should be run," he said, describing the dock infrastructure there as very run down. He also said rules and matters of general courtesy are rarely adhered to and seldom enforced, if at all, at Sioux City's public boat ramp and docks. In light of that, Corey said he's leaning toward using the South Sioux City boat ramp this year. Our next headline is, recyclers say bottle bill reform made trouble. 2-year-old changes to Iowa's recycling law have resulted in fewer places for Iowans to return their recyclable bottles and cans to redeem the 5-cent per container deposit, a group of Iowa recyclers said on Monday. A key state lawmaker said if the state recycling program struggles, the next legislative move may be to repeal the law. Under Iowa's recycling program, consumers pay a 5-cent deposit on most plastic and aluminum beer and soda containers. They can recoup that nickel by returning empty containers to redemption centers or retailers. The program was created to encourage Iowans to recycle their plastic and aluminum bottles and cans. States with deposit laws have a beverage recycling rate of about 60%, while states without deposits have a recycling rate of about 24%, according to the Container Recycling Institute. In 2022, the state repealed the requirement that grocery and convenience stores accept return recyclables. That new law also increased the fee paid by beverage distributors to redemption centers, with the goal of incentivizing the expansion and creation of more redemption centers across the state. 2 years later, the number of state-licensed redemption centers has increased. There are 104 active state-licensed centers, according to the state, but not enough to offset the number of grocery and convenience stores that got out of the recycling business, according to members of the nonprofit advocacy group Cleaner Iowa, which includes recycling companies. The fee increase has led to more redemption centers opening across the state, but more are needed. Mick Berry, a former president of Mid-America Recycling in Des Moines, said Monday at a news conference hosted by Cleaner Iowa at the Iowa Capitol. The unintended consequences of this bill, however, has been actually a net reduction in places to redeem your containers for consumers and citizens of the state, Berry said, and thus creating a lack of convenient redemption as envisioned by Governor Robert Ray and Governor Terry Branstad when they created this law back in 1979. Cleaner Iowa surveyed more than 1,000 Iowa businesses, mainly grocery and convenience stores, and found that only 8.7% of those businesses are redeeming recyclable containers. Furthermore, only 8 of 143 businesses contacted that still are required to participate in the state recycling law are doing so, according to the group. Leaders of the group said they believe that is because Iowans are not aware that they must file a complaint with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources before the state will investigate. The mass exodus of grocery and convenience stores from the program has created what the group is calling recycling deserts, where individuals must travel to the nearest redemption center. There are 29 counties without a redemption center, according to state figures analyzed by Cleaner Iowa. Representative Brian Losey, a Republican from Bondurant, who was a key legislator in writing the 2022 changes into law, said if the state's recycling program struggles under the recently enacted changes, the next step may be to repeal the 5-cent deposit. Losey said, "If this doesn't work, I think the next step is to get rid of it. It's clearly not working across the state. If it's not going to work, what is the next step? I think one of the options on the table has to just repeal it. We tried to fix it, and if it's not going to work, then that may be something we have to take a really hard look at." R.G. Schwarm, executive director of Cleaner Iowa and an Iowa Capitol lobbyist, noted the state recycling program's popularity. A 2022 poll conducted by Selzer and Company for Cleaner Iowa showed 84% of Iowans said the recycling law is good for the state, and said Cleaner Iowa survey was conducted with the hopes of providing an early snapshot of the impact of the 2022 changes to the law. As part of those changes, a legislative committee will review the program in 2025. The bottle bill works, but it's clear there are some areas that need attention, including enforcement issues, Schwamm said in a statement. We hope lawmakers will approach the 2025 Fiscal Review Committee with an open mind and with the objectives to make the bottle bill system that Iowans care about better and more convenient. Sioux City man pleads guilty in child porn case. A Sioux City man who faced 30 counts related to the possession of child pornography has pleaded guilty to 7 of them. Stanley Hill, 82, entered written pleas to 7 counts of sexual exploitation of a minor. As part of a plea agreement entered in the case, the remaining charges will be dismissed. No sentencing agreement was included in the plea deal. 6 of the counts are Class D felonies that carry 5-year prison sentences. The other is an aggravated misdemeanor with a 2-year sentence. A sentencing date has yet to be scheduled. Hill was first charged in September after police found more than 100 photos containing images of naked male and female children under age 18 in his possession. According to court documents, while Hill was jailed after his arrest, he called from the jail to another person asking him or her to clean out his office at home. The person cleaned the office and removed a few items at Hill's request and gathered a thumb drive, opened it, and found photos of male and female children in various stages of nudity. The person turned the drive over to police detectives, who discovered 238 photos, all of which were interwoven with adult pornography. On many of the photos, Hill had added graphic text. According to the plea agreement, each charge Hill pleaded guilty to involved a picture with a different minor child. We'll now move to the regular Tuesday column called Five Questions With, and today is a student from Hinton, Addison Corvarna. It used to be called Future Homemakers of America. For high school students these days, it is known as Family, Career, and Community Leaders of America, or rather, acronym of FCCLA. A Hinton teen, 16-year-old Addison Corvarna, has been elected state president for the student organization. According to the FCCLA website, more than 10 million students have been involved in FCCLA and have changed countless lives around the country by participating in national programs, competing in competitive events, and exploring career pathways. FCCLA is focused on preparing youth for careers that support families and strengthens members' employment skills by preparing students to be college and career ready. Addison is a junior at Hinton High School. She has been involved in FCCLA since 9th grade. The daughter of Josh and Val Corvarna plans to go to dental school following graduation, but exactly where she will go to college remains up in the air. Addison found time to answer questions from the journal for our latest installment of Five Questions With. Comments have been edited for length and clarity. First question, how did you get involved in FCCLA? Answer, I got involved in FCCLA through my 8th grade food and nutrition teacher, Allison Hertenstein, and my boss, who was a junior FCCLA member, told me I would love the organization. Why and how did you decide to run for state president of the organization? I decided to run because I have a passion to help others, and FCCLA is a great organization for me to be a part of, to not only grow my personal goals, but grow others as well. In this day and age, how is FCCLA relevant to young people? And she answers, FCCLA is not a super common thing to be part of, but is definitely on the rise. The northwest part of Iowa is very involved, but there are other parts of the state that aren't as involved. Our state membership is rapidly increasing, making us more relevant to the younger generation. What have you gotten out of your experiences with FCCLA? And she answers, in my few years of FCCLA, I have not only developed my leadership skills, I developed many lifelong friendships. It is a great way for me to connect with people all around the state and the country. I've also been able to continue my passion for traveling. What can a student learn from FCCLA that they will use in their lives? And Addison replies, students can learn many lifelong skills through FCCLA. Through STAR projects, national programs, and other competitions, they can learn about human sciences, culinary, and many other potential career fields. Our next headline is Iowa Supreme Court to hear abortion law arguments Thursday. Rules meant to carry out a blocked Iowa law banning abortions early in pregnancy will move forward, while later this week the Iowa Supreme Court will consider a legal challenge to the constitutionality of the state ban. The State Administrative Rules Committee met Monday to review rules adopted by the State Medicine Board that would apply to a new state law on abortion. Lawmakers raised concerns but did not object to the adopted rules, which will take effect April 24th. However, with the law temporarily blocked, the rules will not be enforceable unless the court allows the law to go forward. The Iowa Supreme Court is set to hear oral arguments Thursday afternoon in Republican Governor Kim Reynolds' appeal of the lower court's decision that paused the crux of the restrictive abortion law from taking effect. Lawmakers last year passed, and Reynolds signed into law House File 732 during a rare special session of the legislature. It would change the amount of time a pregnant person has to seek an abortion from 20 weeks post-fertilization to as little as 6 weeks, before many people know they are pregnant. The law bans abortion once cardiac activity is detected in an embryo or fetus, which can be as early as 6 weeks, and includes exceptions for rape, incest, and medical emergencies. A Polk County District Court judge temporarily blocked the law shortly after its passage last summer, but allowed the rulemaking process to move forward. Physicians have raised concerns about the requirements placed on them, the use of non-medical terminology included in the law, and the impact on recruitment of OBGYNs in the state. While the ban contains some exceptions for abortions, some Iowa physicians have warned the restrictions would hinder their ability to provide appropriate, timely care. Many requested that the Board of Medicine use language that parallels that used by physicians in their practice. While the board revised the rules to include terminologies that doctors use, many of the terms included in the law are defined by state statute and cannot be altered. The law is crafted around the detection of a fetal heartbeat, which is not easily translated to medical science. While advanced technology can detect a flutter of cardiac activity as early as 6 weeks gestation, medical experts say the embryo at that point is not yet a fetus and does not have a heart. The rules instruct physicians to make a bona fide effort to detect a fetal heartbeat by performing a transabdominal pelvic ultrasound. If cardiac activity is detected, defined in the law as the steady and repetitive rhythmic contractions of the fetal heart within the gestational sac, the abortion cannot be performed unless one of the exceptions has been met. The bill includes exceptions for pregnancies the result of rape in cases reported within 45 days, and incest in cases reported within 140 days. It also includes exceptions for miscarriages, a fetal abnormality that would result in an infant's death, and for when the mother's life is threatened. To determine whether patients qualify for the ban's exceptions for rape and incest, Iowa physicians would be required to gather details from the pregnant person to determine when and whether a sex act occurred, including if and when the act was first reported to law enforcement, a public or private health agency, or a family physician. As for determining whether a fetus has an abnormality that in the physician's reasonable medical judgment is incompatible with life, doctors would be required to document diagnostic tests and procedures performed and their results, along with a description as to why they support the diagnosis. The law also provides for an exception for medical emergency, which includes pregnancy complications endangering the life of the pregnant person, and cases in which continuation of the pregnancy will create a serious risk of substantial and irreversible impairment of a major bodily function of the pregnant woman. The board, though, did not provide specific guidance for how badly a pregnant person's health would have to decline before doctors can intervene. Republican lawmakers and supporters of the law say the exceptions allow medical providers to exercise judgment and provide abortions when they believe one applies. Opponents contend the uncertainty and worry among physicians of potentially losing their medical license could prompt providers to put off abortions if they are uncertain. The adopted rules do not outline how the board would determine noncompliance or specific penalties physicians would face for violating the law. Rather, it would be up to the discretion of the board. Existing administrative rules lay out the extent of the punishment the Board of Medicine can impose on physicians and licensees who violate board rules and state laws. The board may revoke, suspend, or restrict someone's license, or place them on a probation period, or require additional education or training. The board may also impose a fine of up to $10,000 and issue a citation and warning. Senator Sidney Winkler, a Democrat from Davenport who serves on the state legislature's Administrative Rules Review Committee, raised concerns with the definition of unborn child included in the rules. The law uses the term unborn child to refer to an embryo or fetus from the time of fertilization to birth. Winkler worried the definition would imperil access to in vitro fertilization in the wake of the Alabama Supreme Court ruling that frozen embryos are children under state law and that those who destroy them can be held liable for wrongful death. I know what the intent is of the law, but because so much of this bill does not really include medical terminology when it was passed, I think it is unfortunate that we have these rules in place and will be in effect before the court case is determined, she said. Maisie Stilwell, Public Affairs Director of Planned Parenthood Advocates of Iowa, said the proposed rules will lead to chaos and confusion within the medical field and interfere with Iowa's access to safe and legal abortion. The way that the bill was written is not in line with medical practice, and so that puts the Board of Medicine in, you know, a position to try to interpret non-medical standards in the practice of medicine, Stilwell said. Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd, a Republican, argues in court filings that the state of Iowa has a vital interest in protecting unborn human life at all stages of development. The brief argues that abortion providers and clinics lack standing to sue on behalf of pregnant women, given that there is no constitutional right to provide abortions with the recent reversal of Iowa and U.S. Supreme Court cases. No right is more valuable than the right to life, Byrd said in a statement last year defending the law. Each day, innocent unborn lives are lost to abortion. We know that every moment counts when it comes to protecting the unborn and are working diligently to ensure the heartbeat law is upheld. I'm confident that the law is on our side and we will continue fighting to defend the right to life in court. Sioux City Council okays Rec Center lease bridge donation. The Sioux City Council moved forward a resolution Monday to lease Long Lines Family Recreation Center's second floor for the operation and management of athletic and sporting events. The city is seeking to collect a $6,500 monthly rental fee for the space, which includes a gymnasium and a lounge area. The climbing wall and party room will be excluded from the lease, according to city documents. Leasing the second floor would reduce the rec center's operating budget per year, as well as the facility's future capital expenditures. A public hearing on the matter will be held May 13th, which is also the date proposals need to be received by. We have had a couple of conversations with folks that expressed interest. I don't know if they're going to be submitting a proposal after today, Sioux City Parks and Recreation Director Matt Salvatore told the council before the vote. We will try to promote that a little bit and see if we can get some interest in that facility. The Arena Sports Academy is currently leasing the second floor. That lease, which was for 3 years, ends this month. Salvatore said improvements under that lease included wall padding in the gymnasium and the remodel of the Chesterman Lounge. The city has since also painted the entire gymnasium and remodeled the two bathrooms adjacent to the Chesterman Lounge, he said. In the fall of 2020, the Sioux City Parks and Recreation Department relocated from the Rec Center to the Siouxland Expo Center, a nearly $15 million multipurpose venue in the former Sioux City Stockyards. The addition of the Expo Center raised uncertainty about the longtime viability of the Rec Center, the former municipal auditorium, which opened in 1950 at 401 Gordon Drive. During the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, the rec center and the climbing wall were closed to the public from March 13th to June 22nd, 2020. When the facility reopened, belaying services at the climbing wall could not be offered due to social distancing guidelines. and limited staff availability. Most of the part-time staff did not return after the long layoff. Last year, the council approved another agreement between the city and Charlotte, North Carolina-based Whitewater, a limited liability company, for the management and operation of the climbing wall. And then the Big Sioux Pedestrian Bridge. The council, by voting in favor of its consent agenda, also accepted a $64,000 donation from the Siouxland Trails Foundation for Phase 2 of the Big Sioux Pedestrian Bridge Crossing Project. The donation will support the project, which is located just north of Interstate 29 and consists of the construction of a pre-engineered steel truss pedestrian bridge over the Big Sioux River, grading, storm sewer, retaining wall construction, and PCC, Portland Cement Concrete, paving for a 10-foot-wide trail connecting South Dakota and Iowa are also included. Last month, the council awarded a $1.8 million contract to a Lincoln, Nebraska construction company for the project's second phase. The bridge, which is expected to be completed in the fall, has a construction budget of $2.6 million and is being funded through a combination of sources, including the Dakota Dunes CID, Sioux City General Obligation Bonds, and Destination Iowa grant funding. A total of $1.4 million of the cost of the bridge is being covered by private contributions. You were listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, April 9th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now move to today's obituaries. Jane S. Rapp, 82, of Sioux City and formerly of South Sioux City, died at Bickford Cottage on Friday, March 22nd, following a lengthy battle with Alzheimer's disease. Her celebration of life will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, April 13th. At First Presbyterian Church in South Sioux City, with Reverend Beth Hamilton officiating. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, April 12th, at First Presbyterian Church with the family present at that time. A private family burial will be at the Ponca City Cemetery, Ponca, Nebraska. Arrangements are under the direction of Moore and Becker Hunt Funeral Home. Jane was born December 8, 1941, in Scottsbluff, Nebraska, to William and Elizabeth Talbert Skinner. She was the middle of three daughters and lived in Scottsbluff until her graduation from Scottsbluff High School in 1959. From there, she continued her education at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where she was an education major. She was active in the Kappa Kappa Gamma sorority and other campus activities. It was at UNL where she met the love of her life, Ronald D. Rapp. Jane married Ron on August 25, 1963, in Scottsbluff. The newly married couple relocated briefly to Biloxi, Mississippi, where Ron was stationed for the 185th Air National Guard. After their time in Biloxi, they moved back to Nebraska and made their home in South Sioux City, where they raised their two sons. Before the arrival of their oldest, Jane accepted a teaching contract for the Sioux City Community School District, where she taught Spanish at Hoover Middle School for 1 year. She devoted herself to becoming a full-time homemaker and mother after that, until her children were older. From there, she held various positions within the community, including church secretary at First Presbyterian Church in South Sioux City, office manager at Tecad Park, counselor at South Sioux City Junior High School, an outpatient counselor at Unity Point. Jane served on the South Sioux City Board of Education for 16 years. While on the board, she served in all local offices as well as served on several committees for the Nebraska Association of School Boards. She also served the Cardinal Educational Foundation for over 25 years, was a church deacon as well as elder and handbell director at First Presbyterian Church of South Sioux City, was a founding member and chapter president of PEO Chapter GX, a member of the Red Hat Society and Correlation of Siouxland. Jane had a great love of many things. Her family was her first and foremost passion. She enjoyed spending time with her children and grandchildren and following them in activities. Other hobbies included entertaining, travel, train riding, boating, reading, puzzles, dominoes, bridge, and relaxing on her deck watching the river go by. All of these paled in comparison to her love and dedication to Nebraska football. Her social calendar was often dictated by the Husker football schedule. Special thanks to Heart of Siouxland Senior Care for their help with Jane before she moved to Bickford Cottage Memory Care, the caring staff at Bickford Cottage Memory Care, and finally Hospice of Siouxland, and especially Tyler for his compassion and care during her last couple of days. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to First Presbyterian Church of South Sioux City or Cardinal Education Foundation. Kenneth M. Johnson, 75, of Sioux City, passed away March 24th at a local hospital. A celebration of his life will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, April 13th, at Christy Smith Funeral Home's Morningside Chapel, with visitation 1 hour prior. Terry L. Jensen, 82, a beloved husband and father, passed away with loved ones at his side on Saturday, April 6th. A celebration of life will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, April 12th, with a visitation 1 hour prior at Waterbury Funeral Service at 4125 Orleans Avenue, Sioux City. He was born to Victor and Geraldine Jensen on May 25, 1941, in Sioux City. Terry graduated from Central High School in 1959. He worked for the post office for 28 years, retiring in 1991. In 1982, Terry met and married Elizabeth Wolkers. The two were happily married for over 41 years. Terry possessed many talents as a craftsman, builder, and do-it-yourselfer. In fact, there was nothing he could not build or fix, especially with Lydie by his side assisting in the project. A signature achievement was his refurbished 1937 Chevy Coupe that placed Best of Show and other high awards in car shows across the Midwest. Neil Clemen, 72, of Olathe, Kansas, passed away March 18th after a brief illness at the Olathe Medical Center in Olathe, Kansas. Memorial services will be held at 2 p.m. Friday, April 12th, at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Kathleen Armbright, 69, of Sioux City, passed away December 19th, 2023. Graveside services will be held 11 a.m. Saturday, April 13th, at Calvary Cemetery. Fellowship to follow at Sun Valley Golf Course in Sioux City. Funeral services for Alice M. Marshall, age 85, of Wayne, Nebraska, will be at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, April 9th, at Evangelical Free Church in Concord, Nebraska. Visitation was Monday at Hasman Funeral Home of Wayne, interment at Coleridge Cemetery in Coleridge, Nebraska. She passed away Thursday, April 4th, at the Providence Medical Center in Wayne. Memorials may be directed to the Marshall family for later designation. Okay, I don't know that I'm going to figure out how to say this last name. Dirk Svi Breitsprak, and that's spelled Breitsprak, 69, of Kansas City, formerly of Sioux City, passed away on Wednesday, March 13th, in a local hospice house. Dirk deeded his body to the University of Iowa Medical School for research to help cure many diseases. Dirk was born on October 22, 1954, in Sioux City. He was a son of Dr. Janice Svee and Victor Breitsprak. Dirk graduated from North High School in 1973. He enlisted in the U.S. Army in 1974 and served until 1976. Dirk attended Simpson College in Indianola, Iowa, and Cole College in Cedar Rapids. He went on to Washington, D.C. Culinary School to become a chef. He enjoyed bowling, fishing, and cooking. He was also a member of the Cheyenne Social Club. Joyce Tromp, 80, of Battle Creek, Iowa, passed away on January 12th. Celebration of Life brunch will be at 10 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Saturday, April 13th, at the Mapleton Community Center in Mapleton, Iowa. Interment will be at the Mount Hope Cemetery in Mapleton. Arrangements are by the Armstrong Van Houten Funeral Home of Mapleton. And that concludes the obituaries for today. We'll continue with another news story. Mother of teen who died at Rosecrans dismisses suit. A mother whose 17-year-old son died of drug overdose while staying at a Sioux City drug addiction treatment center has dismissed her negligence lawsuit against the company. Rebecca Strickland, who lives in Polk County, Iowa, had sued Rosecrans Jackson Centers in November, saying the staff there failed to search her son's clothing for contraband when he was admitted. Gage Reiner died at the facility on December 16, 2021, of an overdose on a mixture of drugs, including fentanyl, less than 48 hours after his admission. The lawsuit, filed in Woodbury County District Court, was dismissed Wednesday. The dismissal did not say if a settlement had been reached. All I can say is the case has been resolved, Strickland's attorney, Paul Lundberg of Sioux City, said on Monday. A Rosecrans spokeswoman said the company would have no comment on the lawsuit's dismissal. Reiner was admitted to the Rosecrans residential facility on December 14, 2021, and diagnosed with opioid addiction, other stimulant use, PTSD, and major depressive disorder. Staff members found him face down and fully clothed in his bed at approximately 7 a.m. on December 16, and it was apparent that he had died several hours earlier. An autopsy determined Reiner died from a drug overdose involving fentanyl, sertraline, and amphetamine, and the medical examiner found a clear plastic bag containing a crushed fentanyl tablet in his underwear. The lawsuit said there was no documentation that Rosecrans staff members followed their policy of having Reiner remove his clothing for inspection and a body check at the time he was admitted. The lawsuit also said staff members did not perform required overnight bed and safety checks, resulting in Reiner's death not being discovered for several hours. Man pleads not guilty of robbing North Sioux City Bank. A Sioux City man has pleaded not guilty of robbing a North Sioux City bank. Dennis Manchester, 44, entered his pleas Monday in Union County Circuit Court to charges of first-degree robbery, aggravated assault, grand theft, and driving under suspension. His trial is scheduled for August 12th. Manchester is charged with walking into Liberty National Bank at 113 Military Road on the afternoon of March 12th, handing a teller a note that demanded money or someone would be hurt and displaying a knife. According to court documents, Manchester left the bank with $3,508 in cash and fled in a car that had been parked in a nearby parking lot. Police stopped Manchester in Sioux City shortly after the robbery and took him into custody without incident. The money taken from the bank and a knife were recovered from the car. No bank employees were injured in the robbery. We'll now move to sports, and our first sports story is about the Drake Relays. Area athletes meet standards for Drake. When the 114th Drake Relays commence in Des Moines in a few weeks, expect the high school girls' competition to include a number of Northwest Iowa competitors in the throwing events. Spirit Lake sophomore Lauren Travis has already automatically qualified for the games in the shot put with her season best throw of 42 feet 5 inches, which beats the Drake Blue standard of 41 feet, to earn a spot among the 24 qualifiers. The shot put field stands to also include West Lyon senior Jana Turee, as she's tossed a distance of 40.08 this season to rank 7th best in the state. Spirit Lake senior Fran Travis also ranks in the top 15 with a throw of 39.02. Turee also ranks inside the top 10 statewide in the discus with a throw of 128.11, though that sits just over 3 feet shy of the blue standard. Hinton senior Lauren Kunkel could also see an at-large bid or better, as she's recorded a toss of 120.06.5 this season. In the high school boys competition, Sioux City North distance runner Nathaniel Keifel heads the list of area competitors who have automatically qualified. Keifel has met the blue standard in the 1600-meter run, with the star senior has turned in the state's best time of 4 minutes 16.5 seconds. In addition, the senior has nearly met the blue standard in the 3200 with his 10th best time in the state at 9:24.56. Keifel could also make it in the 400, either by automatically qualifying time or by an at-large bid to fill out the field, as he's run a best time of 1:58.60, just shy of the 1:56 standard. Sioux City East senior Eliana Harris has also already qualified in the 100-meter dash, posting at 12:33 for the second-best time of the season so far. Harris also runs a leg on the Black Raiders 4x100-meter relay team that has also qualified. The team, which also includes Grace Eric, Shamaya Grant, and Mia Rice, own the state's second-best time at 49:62 seconds. MOC Floyd Valley, 4x100 girls relay team also has met the blue standard of 51 seconds. The relay, which includes Kaylee Truker, Turney Huss, Maggie McEwen, and Peyton Kleinheslink, has a season best time of 49.65. Like Harris, Truker, a sophomore, has met the blue standard for the 100 meters with a 12.45, which is exactly the mark to meet. Storm Lake junior Mackenzie Harder, Huss, and Eric could also see at-large bids or better before the April 19th deadline. Harris and Huss both placed in the top six at last spring's Drake Relays. In the boys' 100 dash, George Little Rock senior Isaiah Johnson is in contention for a spot, ranking 15th among all classes in Iowa with a time of 11.02. Sioux City East junior Loudon Grimsley is slightly closer to the blue standard of 10.85 with the season's best time of 10.97. Johnson has recorded a 49.80 in the 400 meter, which has a blue standard of 49.50 for the 16-boy race. Spirit Lake senior Carmarin Hussey also is nearly there with a season best run of 49.52 seconds. Bishop Heelan senior Quinn Olson has notched a time of 50.40. Siouxland has a quartet of 110-meter boys hurdlers that are on either side of the blue standard, led by Ethan Stecker, a junior from Spirit Lake, who's recorded a time of 14.72, which got under the 14.80 standard. Stecker's time ranks sixth best in the state, and Central Line senior Reese Vanderzee seventh at 15.78 as automatic qualifiers. Then Heelan junior Hunter Wahab and Spirit Lake junior Cooper Winkle just shy of the blue standard. Spencer's 110 shuttle hurdle relay of Weston Johnson, Sam Hinkley, Preston Pitts, and Dylan Timmer are automatic qualifiers with a time of 1:0.59, which beat the blue standard of 1.01. The Spirit Lake girls will be sending a 400 relay team to Drake with Leah Bullitt, Maggie Brunsma, Faith DeWild, and Anthea Leupold having already automatically qualified. And our next story headline is NAIA all but bans transgender athletes from women's sports. The National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics, or NAIA, announced a policy Monday that all but bans transgender athletes from competing in women's sports at its 241 mostly small colleges across the country. The NAIA Council of Presidents approved the policy in a 20-0 vote at its annual convention in Kansas City. The NAIA, which oversees some 83,000 athletes competing in more than 25 sports, and is believed to be the first college sports organization to take such a step. According to the Transgender Participation Policy, all athletes may participate in NAIA-sponsored male sports, but only athletes whose biological sex assigned at birth is female and have not begun hormone therapy will be allowed to participate in women's sports. A student who has begun hormone therapy may participate in activities such as workouts, practices, and team activities, but not in competition. With the exception of competitive cheer and competitive dance, the NAIA created separate categories for male and female participants, the NAIA said. Each NAIA sport includes some combination of strength, speed, and stamina, providing competitive advantages for male student athletes. As a result, the NAIA policy for transgender student athletes applies to all sports except for competitive cheer and competitive dance, which are open to all students. There is no known number of transgender athletes at the high school and college levels, though it is believed to be small. The topic has nonetheless become a hot-button issue among conservative groups and others who believe transgender athletes should not be allowed to compete on girls' and women's sport teams. The NAIA said in a statement to the Associated Press that the NAIA understands that legal action being taken to challenge the policy is a possibility, but this policy is one our membership and board felt like was the right decision. Shawali Patel, a senior counsel at the National Women's Law Center, said her organization was outraged by the NAIA policy. Patel said in a statement, "This is unacceptable and blatant discrimination that not only harms trans, non-binary, and intersex individuals, but limits the potential of all athletes. It's important to recognize that these discriminatory policies do not enhance fairness in competition. Instead, they send a message of exclusion and reinforce dangerous stereotypes that harm all women." Last month, more than a dozen current and former college athletes filed a federal lawsuit against the NCAA, accusing the sport's governing body for more than 500,000 athletes of violating their rights by allowing transgender women to compete in women's sports. Hours after the NAIA announcement, the NCAA released a statement. "College sports are the premier stage for women's sports in America, and the NCAA will continue to promote Title IX, make unprecedented investments in women's sports, and ensure fair competition for all student athletes in all NCAA championships." At least 24 states have laws barring transgender women and girls from competing in certain women's or girls' sports competitions. The Biden administration originally planned to release a new federal Title IX rule. The law forbids discrimination based on sex, addressing both campus sexual assault and transgender athletes. Earlier this year, the department decided to split them into separate rules, and the athletics rule now remains in limbo, even as the sexual assault policy moves forward. Patel said the NAIA ban, along with the state laws, emphasizes the urgency in having clear Title IX rules that expressly prohibit this type of sex-based discrimination and ensure the rights of all students, including transgender, non-binary, and intersex athletes, be safeguarded. Trans athletes deserve a chance to play. The NCAA has had a policy for transgender athletic participation in place since 2010, which called for 1 year of testosterone suppression treatment and documented testosterone levels submitted before championship competitions. In 2022, the NCAA revised its policies on transgender athlete participation in an attempt to align with national sport governing bodies, following the lead of the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic committees. The three-phase implementation of the policy included a continuation of the 2010 policy requiring transgender women to be on hormone replacement therapy for at least 1 year, plus a submission of a hormone level test before the start of both the regular season and the championship events. The third phase, as national and international sport governing body standards to the NCAA's policy and after a delay, is scheduled to be implemented for the 24-25 school year on August 1st. There are some 15.3 million public high school students in the United States, and a 2019 study by the CDC estimated 1.8% of them, about 275,000, are transgender. The number of athletes within that group is much smaller. A 2017 survey by Human Rights Campaign suggested fewer than 15% of all transgender boys and transgender girls play sports. The number of NAIA transgender athletes would be far smaller. We'll now move to Dear Abby. I think we have time for maybe one letter. And we'll begin with, "Dear Abby, I'm a soft-spoken person. I work in a medical laboratory, and I'm finally speaking up for what I believe in after years of social anxiety and depression. At the last meeting, when asked by a manager for suggestions to improve the lab workflow, I spoke up. Fast forward to tonight. When I expressed some excitement about my idea, the site leader, a different manager, shot my idea down, saying, 'It's not going to make a difference.' This isn't the first time she has made me feel like my ideas are dumb or that I'm not intelligent, and I snapped. I asked her what idea she had, and she looked as if I had offended her, but she's done this numerous times since she came here. Meanwhile, she has her favorite person in the lab who gets away with murder. Was I wrong for getting upset at her? I just feel like my suggestions go unnoticed or are scoffed at, but when another person comes up with something similar, she applauds them. Signed, Had Enough in the Midwest." And the response: "Blowing up at the manager may have felt good at the moment after years of silence caused by depression and social anxiety, but it was the wrong thing to do. That kind of behavior does not belong in a professional environment. Favoritism happens in many work environments, and it can be frustrating. If you can't find a way to accept it, you might be happier working at a different lab. Dear Abby, my stepdaughter has two children. She married a man who has one child, Haley. They have been married 4 years, and Haley turned 18 last year. We have seen her only 5 or 6 times, and she seems uninterested in getting to know us. The first Christmas, I went out of my way to give her gifts I thought she would enjoy as a teenager. The next Christmas, she didn't spend any time with the family, so I sent her a gift home with her dad, but never heard a word from her. Last year, Haley graduated from high school and started working. Because we weren't going to see them at Christmas, I sent the other grandchildren gifts but did not include Haley. My stepdaughter got upset because we left Haley out. We explained that, one, she never acknowledges the gifts we send, and she is now an adult, and we never see her. Are we wrong not to include her? Signed, perplexed about stepfamily etiquette. And the response. The answer to your question is yes and no. Haley does not appear to be a child who is easy to love. She has certainly given you no reason to. However, in the interest of family harmony, it was wrong to exclude her entirely. Not knowing the young woman, it would be hard to know what she might have liked to receive. Next year, send her a coffee shop gift card with a sweet note so she won't feel she is being ignored as she has ignored you. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, April 9th. I'm your reader, Dagna. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening.